The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last year, Donate Life America took a big risk. The nonprofit that manages the National Organ Donor Registry and promotes awareness of the need for organ donation created an ad specifically targeted at young men, a demographic notoriously difficult to reach through traditional methods. Here's just a bit of the nearly three-minute ad.
This is a story about Coleman Sweeney. Coleman, in short, was an ass. Everyone in his small town knew it. It wasn't that he tried particularly hard to be unpleasant. It just seemed to come naturally to him. Coleman felt like the whole world owed him something.
And the gamble paid off. That video was viewed more than 80 million times online, and Donate Life reported a 586% increase in daily registrations. So how much money did Donate Life pay for an advertising feat that most for-profit companies would pay millions for? Absolutely nothing. Tony Case is executive editor of Adweek and joins us now to talk about the success of this campaign and other pro bono success stories. Tony, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thank you for having us.
So I should mention, I can't actually say the name of the ad, which includes a word we definitely can't say on public radio, so we bleeped it out. But let's just say the gist of the story is that Coleman Sweeney is a real jerk.
Yes, that's the nice word to use. How do I say this? The name of the campaign was actually the world's biggest A dash dash hole.
Okay, we can do that.
For you, public radio? Okay.
So how is this jerkiness on display?
Well, Thomas Jane, the actor, played the lead character, Coleman Sweeney. You just played the clip. And he's as you say, a real jerk. You know, he goes through life and he flicks his cigarettes at people. And he does a lot worse things that I also don't want to talk about here because the ad's pretty graphic. But he's a jerk. You know, everybody knows somebody like this or has seen somebody like this. So what happens in the spot is he dies, and it turns out he was an organ donor. So the kicker is he was this horrible person, and yet he went on to save half a dozen lives because his heart went here, his eyes went there. So it's a very effective ad. The coarseness of it made it unusual, and it also made it a hard sell for the ad agency, the Martin Agency in Virginia, not to be gratuitous, but to get through to, as you had pointed out, young men. The thinking was they sort of had to speak their language to get through to them, and it worked.
Well, so this is the guy, Coleman Sweeney. He, you know, steals women's underwear from a laundromat. He steals children's Halloween candy, haggles with a waitress over fries, you know, in his lunch special. This guy is
great American.
He's a great American. An A dot, dot, dot hole, as you put it so nicely. Now, this is pretty daring. This is a nonprofit that deals with the serious subject of life and death every day. How did they get Donate Life to sign up on this concept and in a word that the FCC won't allow?
It took months, according to the agency. They had this client in Donate Life, this charity, and, you know, as one of the creatives whose idea this was told me, that world, the world of nonprofits, is sort of used to campaigns around lollipops and rainbows and butterflies. And he said that it was, you know, an enormous leap for them to even consider something this edgy. They went through all sorts of iterations. Can we use the word jerk? Can we use, and nothing quite had the same punch because, again, these are young men who, you know, young men. I think they
use something a little stronger than jerk. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. They had to get through to them. They had to speak their own language. That's the point.
Let me stop you there so we can pick some of this apart, because that this is the Martin Agency that you mentioned. They donated their service. They came up with the concept. The actor, the directors all donated their time. Is this something that ever happens in the advertising world, even for nonprofits?
It happens more and more. Hmm. Advertising agencies in particular have their favorite causes, as do, you know, companies in general nowadays. And so they tend to donate all their services for free. They have relationships with, production companies, production crews, actors. In the case of the Donate Life ad, all of the production was pro bono. Even the Thomas Jane, who's a fairly, A-list actor, donated his time. Craft Service donated its time. So we are seeing more of this because, of course, they're nonprofits. They don't have the kind of budget that Budweiser does to create a multi-million dollar ad campaign.
My guest is Tony Case. He's executive editor of Adweek, and he's with us to talk about the runaway success of a really controversial ad for Donate Life that may signal a new direction for nonprofit marketing. So puncturing through that crowded media universe takes polish, concept, A-list actor in this case, or in another case, less work. Another viral ad that took a different approach for a nonprofit last year was the Fur Kids Animal Rescue and Shelters ad.
You don't like tails? No problem. Get a cat without one.
All of our cats are self-cleaning and cleaning and cleaning and cleaning and cleaning and cleaning. 2016 models are compatible with Windows.
So how long have you been waiting to get adopted?
You like hungry cats? We got some of the hungriest cats you've ever seen. Seriously.
Nearly 5 million views for this, a local animal shelter ad. And you can hear, somebody holding the camera laughing. They said the cost of the ad was a couple cans of cat food. So what makes this kind of thing work?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there's no way to predict. It's like somebody starting a record company and saying, we're only going to put out hit records, right? I mean, there's no predicting what's going to go viral. And you do have these ads that resonate. I mean, this had everything. This had humor. It had cats. Who doesn't, love cats on the internet? You get lucky sometimes, and they got really lucky. And for a great cause. That's what's so terrific about all of these, because cause marketers, as someone told me recently in that side of the business, you're not really just competing with other charities. You're competing with the Budweisers and the Skippy peanut butters and the Tide detergents of the world. You're competing with all marketers, which makes it even tougher. And they really do rely on the expertise of these creative agencies, who obviously are the experts at this. They count on developing relationships with them and having them sort of lead the charge on these great marketing ideas. And sometimes they get really lucky and they're a big hit and it really, really serves to benefit the charity.
Right. And now there are agencies that are trying to look like they cobbled things together. Are there other examples that you have of nonprofit campaigns that have really worked or real duds?
The duds, they tend to just sort of disappear. There's one that really stands out, and that is, and I should say that just as marketers in general are using the latest technology in a lot of their campaigns, so are cause marketers. There's a charity called Charity Water, and Charity Water did a black tie event at the Metropolitan Museum here in New York last December. 400 people came to this very formal event. They all strapped on these VR headsets, and they took a tour of a small village in Ethiopia, and they were watching this sort of virtual reality movie documenting a week in the life of a 13-year-old girl and her family who were getting access to clean water for the first time.
Yeah.
And you know, from what I gather about this event, you know, of course, it's this incredible location, this incredible venue, you know, the Metropolitan Museum, everybody's there in their black tie, they've got the headset strapped on. I mean, from what I gather, you could really hear a pin drop. This was quite compelling. And if you've ever done virtual reality, I don't know if you've ever experienced that, Virginia.
I have not.
It is quite something.
That sounds amazingly effective.
It is quite something. They were these sort of Samsung Gear VR headsets. And this was a very clever and rather inexpensive way to get the message out about charity water to, you know, a group of sort of, you know, 400 well-heeled New Yorkers. And the upshot is, by the end of the night, donors had committed $2.4 million to charity water, much more than the charity had expected. So, you know, it's not just video, it's not just internet, it's not just television. Marketers are using all kinds of ways to break through this sort of marketing clutter. And we're going to be seeing more and more experimentation like that.
Worlds collide at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Tony, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Tony Casey's executive editor of Adweek magazine. And you can watch the ads that we talked about. We really encourage you to do it. I defy you not to get misty. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There's plenty of overt fat shaming in American culture, from magazine covers to infomercials to stand-up comedy. Ridiculing overweight people has become normalized in the language of the moment. Discrimination on the basis of weight is legal in 49 states. Michigan is the only holdout. Sometimes it is done under the guise of concern over the obesity epidemic or to encourage a healthier lifestyle. In reality, fat shaming has the opposite effect. Alex Orloff is a staff writer for Mike.com, and she wrote about research on the adverse effects of fat shaming. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I just mentioned some obvious ways of fat shaming. What are the less obvious?
I think that instances of fat shaming are just occurring all around us, whether it's on the subway, during a morning commute, maybe a glare here or there, when an overweight person orders something at a restaurant and perhaps other people are rolling their eyes, or the way fat characters are depicted in movies and on TV shows. I think there are so many ways that people who are overweight feel unwelcome in certain spaces.
Fat shaming makes people feel bad, but you found research that shows it actually has physical effects. What are they?
I found several studies that confirmed that fat shaming causes levels of the hormone cortisol to spike. And researchers say this is a stress hormone that has been linked with overeating and binge eating.
So fat shaming causes a spike, which actually could make people eat more.
Exactly.
How about dieting? That can be a really stressful thing. What does that do for a person who's overweight and may feel badly about it?
Yeah, that's a great point. Dieting is very tricky because in theory, we lose weight when we're eating fewer calories than the calories that we're burning. But researchers, especially neurologists, have looked into this and have noticed that the stress from dieting and the pressure to adhere to strict regimens is associated with that hormone, cortisol, spiking again.
So that's not good. I mean, once you get a cortisol spike, how does it come back down?
You know, that's a great question, and I'd be interested to learn the answer to that. I think it's not an easy fix. It's really emotional eating, binge eating. These are things that aren't completely in our control. And I think that's part of the difficulty of this situation is that people are blaming themselves when they fail, when in fact there are so many factors that are leading them to gain weight.
Well, actually, that is something that's brought up a lot. You know, you have to have willpower in order to diet. You have to have willpower in order to get yourself to exercise. What does the data tell us about willpower?
You know, there's this prevailing notion that if you want it bad enough, you can transform your body. But that's really not the case. It's not about willpower or self-discipline. There are so many factors that go into whether someone will become overweight or will become diabetic. It's genes, it's your lifestyle, it's food marketers pushing products on us. To say that it's simply willpower is extremely reductive.
I also remember reading something. The New York Times did a big follow-up on people who were contestants on The Biggest Loser. So that's one of those shows where they try to lose the most possible weight. And they found that the contestants were eating nothing and still unable to lose weight. What was going on metabolically?
That's a really great article. Metabolically, researchers have found that when people lose a great amount of weight, their metabolism actually changes. So they have to eat a fewer amount of calories than someone who is their same size. So say 150-pound woman who has lost a great deal of weight to get to 150 pounds, her metabolism will be radically different from a 150-pound woman who has not lost a significant amount of weight. So really, the odds are kind of stacked against these people.
So, all right, so we're getting stigma in the media, real difficulty metabolically, but also doctors have a demonstrable anti-fat bias. Tell us what you found about this.
So I talked to a doctor in Canada about this issue, and he told me doctors can't see past this heavy frame. There's no community of doctors that has really been able to treat patients regardless of their weight. Doctors see the weight and oftentimes attribute the weight to other symptoms a patient may be having. So, for example, providers aren't looking at the individual in front of them and taking a comprehensive medical and social history. They're kind of latching onto the idea that this patient may need to lose weight. There's a great article on the website Stat. A woman, Rebecca Hills, was advised to lose weight to combat a persistent cough. But in fact, it was one of her lungs that was causing these respiratory symptoms. And she eventually had to have the lung removed. But she had multiple doctors telling her that her symptoms were due to her weight.
So the bias against people who are overweight actually affects their medical care.
Exactly. And it goes even more than that. Overweight people will visit the doctor and have these negative experiences where they're criticized for their weight. And that might make them less likely to seek medical help in the future.
So, Alex, after looking at this, what do you think could be a better method or way of addressing weight problems?
I think the solution starts with talking to people who are overweight and talking to people who are obese about how they would like to be treated, what makes them feel badly and what makes them feel supported, and recognizing these instances of implicit bias in the medical community and working together to figure out how we can reduce fat shaming and separate fat shaming from health.
Alex Orlov, she's a staff writer for Mike.com. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On March 22nd of last year, two suicide bombers killed 32 men and women in two separate coordinated attacks in Brussels. Neither an attack in Turkey, just 9 days before, nor a suicide bombing in Iraq a week later captured anything like the same level of international attention. It's not news that some attacks incite more media coverage, Facebook profile pictures, and international response than others. Though Karin Mahajan argues that in some parts of the world, small assaults have become almost commonplace and maybe even more traumatic for survivors who are left forgotten as the rest of the world moves on. Karin is author of The Association of Small Bombs. It's a novel inspired by a real bombing in Delhi in 1996, not far from where he lived as a child. We spoke to him last spring when the novel first came out, just after the attack in Brussels, and he talked about the far-reaching implications of living with terror that is not considered newsworthy. Karin, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how do you distinguish a small from a large bombing?
It's a great question and one I had to think about a lot for my novel. And I think that in my novel, I use the word small bombing somewhat ironically because understandably a bomb in which even five lives are lost is a big bombing, especially for the people involved. But I think that the way I would distinguish between a small and a large bombing would be in the amount of news coverage the event receives. And there are certain attacks that blip into the news for a day and then vanish without any further investigation into the lives of the people who've suffered in the attack or the people who carried them out. Whereas there's others, like let's say the Boston bombing, which in some ways is small, if you're going to use the ironic quotation marks there, but receives a lot of attention, which I think is good, and then becomes larger in the consciousness of people.
Well, in the kind of motivating event in your book, the bombing in Lajpat Nagar when you were a kid, do you remember that from your childhood?
I remembered a little bit about it, and I think that's why I was interested in it, is that I had the seed of the actual marketplace in my mind. I knew the shops which had been affected. I knew that my grandmother had been there a day before the attacks, and that as a family we felt, wow, this is something that could have hurt one of us. But it really didn't stay with me at that time. It became one of many catastrophes that India was suffering. It was only years later that I became interested again in that blast because it seemed so forgotten. And I think I wanted to rectify my own lack of memories of that attack, and I went back and did a lot of research.
Now, that bombing is a pre-9/11 attack, which is itself a very American-centric appraisal of the world that we live in. How do you think that threshold for what constitutes a small, seemingly forgettable bombing has shifted since 9/11?
That's a great question because I think my novel is partly about this question, which is that even in India, we didn't pay as much attention to terrorism before 9/11 as we did after. And there's a sense in which the attention that was brought to the problem by 9/11 was absorbed by all these other countries as well. And what was very interesting to me about going back and researching the 1996 blast is that the victims of that blast in Delhi felt they'd been truly neglected by the government, that they hadn't been compensated, that the court case had not been expedited. But when 9/11 happened, they had this feeling that the government is finally going to pay attention to us. And there was actually a news story done where they were interviewed, and they were surprisingly very pro-George Bush because they felt that he was taking some action. And that was an interesting development, I thought, that there's a sort of post-colonial complex that countries like India have where we don't sometimes pay attention to our own problems till the West has.
Well, and in your book, it's also that attack also becomes seeds for radicalization for some of the characters. One of the characters says, small bombs concentrate the pain on the lives of a few. Better to kill generously. But they don't necessarily have big bombs or big strategies. So is that part of the question here? You know, if you don't have a lot, you just use a small bomb, and they couldn't even pull that off in some cases.
Yeah, no, I think this again speaks to the fact that terrorism has become horribly internationalized, and now you have all these splinter groups and smaller organizations that are trying to do copycat attacks. And in the Indian context, a lot of these groups are fairly incompetent. Sometimes they, as you said, don't actually have a larger strategy in mind. They're simply nihilists who are seeking a kind of attention for their political or religious causes. And I think it seemed interesting to me to explore these slightly failed terrorists as opposed to talk about the ones that we are constantly discussing in the news anyway.
Well, and you do explore the lives of some of these terrorists, which is very interesting. This is something we have not, we've obviously heard so much about the roots of terrorism and what turns a person into a terrorist, but not really looking at them as a psychological portrait. That must have been really something to approach in fiction because, you know, there's an idea that you might be humanizing terrorists. What was the risk there for you?
Well, there was, I think, more than a risk, there was just the danger that I wouldn't be able to pull it off, because I think when novelists try to humanize people who are doing monstrous deeds, there's a tendency to overcompensate, to try to make them overly sympathetic. And I think that can actually be a mistake. And my discovery as I was writing the book was that, look, I don't have to, in order to humanize this particular small-time terrorist, say that this person is actually deeply a good person who has had some kind of childhood abuse, which is why he's turned to terror. Instead, I realized I could just show this person as a kind of technician who is interested in assembling a bomb, the difficulties that he might go through in gathering the materials for the bomb, the journey he might have to take, the risks that are involved, and that itself would be illuminating for a reader, and would also, in a strange way, I think, minimize the word terror in our mind, because part of the hole that terrorists have in our imagination is that we've exalted them and turned them into these larger-than-life figures, when in fact, they're just criminals, and they're criminals who are operating within a vocabulary that seems scary to us.
But they also have the power to instill fear and vulnerability, and that unites, motivates, activates people. Of course, the media would jump on something like that, right?
Well, I'd say one reason, for example, that as a novelist I'm interested in terrorism is that, as you said, terrorists commit crimes for ideological reasons. And they're trying to basically alter the consciousness of a culture. This is something that Don DeLillo writes about in one of his novels. Because effects of a bomb, though it might have happened in one small part of a city, radiate outwards and instill fear in the entire city, it does become something that the media is interested in.
Right.
So yeah, there's a difference. There's certainly a difference between just a common crime and terrorists, but I think that we shouldn't play too much into that either.
What is a small bombing, and how do we as individuals and communities respond to a world where terrorism is commonplace? Well, these are some of the questions we're discussing with the author Karan Mahajan. His new novel is called The Association of Small Bombs. Well, it's also a way that it affects populations. I mean, obviously, the aftermath of the bombing that you're talking about in 1996, you know, it changes the social fabric. People are afraid to go out for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But then increasingly we do go out. You know, we stop saying, if we stop what we're doing, the terrorists win. But
mm-hmm.
alternately, living life as normal requires courting danger on some level. You know, is there a risk in places that have a lot of small bombings that people become sort of immune to the possibility of tragedy?
I don't know if that's the case. I think what I would say is that when I was doing my research into the subject and when I was writing about how victims respond to terrorism on a personal level, the only long-term solution, I think, is forgetting. That it's a very human thing to forget, and it's a very positive thing, but that as long as a bomb is in your memory, whether you're going about your daily life or whether you're choosing to stay inside, it still has a hold on you. And I would say that luckily for us, we tend to forget.
I'm thinking about, the American, or let's say the Western-centric response to acts of terrorism in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia, for example. You know, it's something that always happens over there. You know, we don't think of it in the same way. But also here in the U.S., I would dare say that the more we hear about mass shootings, for example, the
mm-hmm.
less outrage they're met with, you know, the less surprised we are about it. So what happens in a place where there are small bombs happening monthly, weekly, even daily in some places? Are they less outrageous?
I don't know if the outrage ever goes away, but I completely agree that there is a parallel between the school shootings that happen in America and the smaller attacks that happen in the U.S. in third world countries. I would also add that what happens, I think, is that the burden of mourning falls upon the individuals caught in these small attacks, and it isn't shared by the rest of the population. So I'll give you an example. When this 1996 Lajpat Nagar bombing happened, there was probably news coverage for 2 or 3 days. But then the country, because it's so huge and it has so many other catastrophes, understandably forgot about the bombing. And then you have all these shopkeepers and you have all these shoppers who have been injured, who now are left alone to deal with the fallout of this huge public event. And none of them know how to deal with it, essentially. And what happens to them over a 10-year period or a 15-year period is unknown. And it's very different from something like the Boston Marathon attack, where though the injuries were vast and a few people were killed, you at least know that the government is helping out in certain ways. There's sympathetic media coverage, that people don't feel like the attack was completely meaningless, that they suffered a completely meaningless tragedy. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the thing that I was trying to address with my novel, the question of how do you make meaning out of something that can seem so inherently meaningless?
I also think that there are a lot of Americans who feel a sense of maybe liberal guilt, we could say, that we mm-hmm. should see all lives equally and experience mm-hmm. news about attacks in Iraq on the same mm-hmm. level of horror as those that took place in Brussels. But do you think that's possible, to feel that on the same level? You know, people who've been to Paris, they haven't been to South India. Is it possible to feel that on the same level?
Sadly, I think it's not. And I don't necessarily think it's a huge failing either. I think it's just a very natural human instinct. If you don't know a place, you tend to empathize a little less with the things that are happening there. And I actually think that's why novelistic treatments of so-called smaller bombings are important, because what a novel does is it creates a set of characters for you that you can deeply connect with. It really shows you the place and immerses you in the setting. And then when you're exposed to this tragedy, it's no longer an abstract paragraph that you've read in the New York Times. That is one of many paragraphs you're going to read that day. I think that this is really a place where art needs to step in, and that it can't be done by the media alone.
Short of art, though, how could the media be covering these kind of small bombings differently?
That's a wonderful question, and one I haven't been asked before. I think that the main thing that the media needs to do is follow up on how the investigations into these attacks are being conducted, because there's two problems that arise, especially in third world countries, with these attacks. The first is that governments, in the initial show of strength, tend to make a lot of arrests, and sometimes without much legal basis. And they also hold innocent people in jail for long periods of time. And the second, of course, is that once the case does begin, but it's gone out of the media spotlight, then the government kind of forgets about it, and it drags on, and both the victims and the innocent people who've been arrested for these attacks just sort of rot in their own private stew of feelings. And if there was a sort of media attention that came back and looked at these cases carefully, it would force the governments in these countries to act on the initial promises they'd made. And that's very important, that it shouldn't just be the sensationalism of the initial event, but also all the boring stuff that follows.
Mm. Karin, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Karin Mahajan, author of The Association of Small Bombs. We spoke to him last year, not long after the terrorist attacks in Brussels. His novel is now out in paperback. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Jazar, Delay, Ketza, and Jason Leonard. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And we invite you to listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And if you like the podcast, we encourage you to rate it. It really helps other people find it, because everything goes so much further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.